Good morning. Welcome to Mid Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. Just a reminder that Vice President Al Gore will be talking to the nation tonight in a speech that many say he will use to drop out of the presidential race. In the first half of mid-morning, we were talking about the legal implications of last night's U.S. Supreme Court ruling. In this half, we're going to be talking about some of the political implications. And, of course, that speech tonight by Vice President Al Gore, that'll be the centerpiece. We'll be talking today to David Yaloff. He's a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. He also researches constitutional law. He joins us by phone. Professor Yaloff, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We've got that big speech tonight. We don't know at what point Vice President Al Gore will talk to the nation. What's he going to say?
Well, obviously there are speechwriters right now furiously trying to figure it out. I think obviously his choice of language will be very cautious. I think he'll probably make the point that the process that's taken place over the last 35 days was a healthy one. I think he'll probably make the point that a lot came out, that we learned a lot about the political system, that some, if not all, questions were answered, because obviously he wanted further recounts and didn't get them. But I think part of the talk tonight will be in implicit defense of the last 35 days. I don't think he wants his legacy to be that he led the country through something for 35 days that didn't have some kind of positive aspect to it. He may also talk generally about how the system needs to be improved, that obviously that questions remain about the system. But my guess would be that the bottom line is he's going to, throw his support behind Governor Bush in terms of the transition. He may even refer to him as President-elect Bush, which would be probably the big soundbite of the evening. And I think he'll probably ask his supporters to do the same.
All right. Now, that's what Vice President Al Gore has to do in a talk tonight. We're hoping to hear from Texas Governor George W. Bush. He's declined to comment on the Supreme Court ruling, but when he's been asked by reporters if the nation would hear from him soon, he has said, "I hope so. We'll see." When he does talk to the nation, what does he have to say?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I think his big task before him is going to be healing. He is going to have to reach across party lines, and in the next couple weeks, he's going to have to reach across ideological lines. He's going to have to present himself to those who not only supported Al Gore, but believed in the end that Al Gore did win Florida and win the election, that he is prepared to listen to them, that he wants to be a healer, wants to be a uniter. He's going to have to go back to a lot of the rhetoric that we heard during the campaign, and he's going to have to talk again about that. And, here's what's going on beneath the surface. There are a lot of individuals in Congress, especially Republicans, who have been waiting for this for a long time. There has not been a Republican president and two branches of Congress, both Republican, for a very long time. You'd have to go back to the 1950s. As a result, a lot of people are prepared to present initiatives and go forward in ways that they haven't been able to go before. He's going to have to somehow let the public know that not all of them are acceptable, that this is a close election, even though he did win it, and that he is prepared to be a bipartisan president.
Now, so many people have been saying that this ruling gives Bush the presidency, but what kind of presidency?
Well, it's still a presidency.
Yeah.
We have had presidents before, Catherine, who faced a Congress that was totally against him. Obviously, Bill Clinton, for the last 6 years, has faced a Republican Senate and a Republican House. It is not that daunting a prospect, if you consider that possibility, with what Bush has, which is, at least nominally, a Republican House and a Republican-controlled Senate. So, I don't think we should pretend that this is an easy situation, but I don't think we should oversimplify the notion that nobody has faced obstacles like George W. Bush. People have faced a lot more formidable obstacles when they're going against Congress. He will have a Congress that wants to see him succeed, at least half of the Congress that will want him to succeed. And so it is still the presidency. I think the presidency is a lot stronger in many ways than the people who assume the presidency. And so from that standpoint, the power of appointment and the power to persuade and the bully pulpit will still be there. It is going to be, though, the greatest test of George W. Bush's political abilities. And so it will be interesting to watch.
Now, we're talking politics. Usually you don't like to talk politics when you talk at the U.S. Supreme Court. Talk for a minute about this ruling and what political implications there are for the court from this ruling.
Well, there are a lot of political implications about for the court, because I think the result was in many ways everybody's worst nightmare. We suspected that there were five individuals on the court that were more conservative and that there were four individuals.
I'm going to interject here. Is it fair to talk about a Supreme Court justice as conservative or liberal? I mean, it's almost as if we're making them partisan.
Well, you know, are we talking about party partisanship, or are we talking about ideological?
Mm.
And that's an important distinction, Catherine, because consider that David Souter was a Republican his entire life. Consider that John Paul Stevens was a Republican and appointed by Gerald Ford. So in the strict partisan sense, you would think that they are Republicans. But they have been grouped, along with Breyer and Ginsburg, as the liberal-slash-moderate bloc on the court. That's where their votes have been in federalism issues. That's where their votes have been in constitutional rights issues. And so that kind of bloc, if you will, has held steady and had somewhat, you know, been pretty stable through a lot of different kinds of legal issues. So is it fair? I mean, I think by their votes and by the consistency of their votes and their allegiances, they've made it fair game. We cannot look at what the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court justices have done over the last 10 years and say, my God, who knows where any of them will be? We have a pretty good idea before these cases come down where most of them will be.
All right. But the political implications of this ruling, is the court damaged somehow?
I think the court is damaged a little bit in the short run. And I think that's because they decided to take the case, which I think alone opens up a lot of questions. Why would they interfere with Florida state politics? Do they really want to get involved in this? And so I think the initial assault on them is on the basis of the fact that they even entered the what Felix Frankfurter would call the political thicket. And then the second basis of the assault is going to be, and when it came right down to it, you didn't vote based on any notion of objective legal standards, any notion of statutory language or constitutional language. It's just too coincidental to most people that all five of the more conservative, quote-unquote, justices believed in the end that no recount was possible, and that the four, quote-unquote, moderate liberal justices all believed a recount was possible and was required. It's just too convenient, too coincidental, and so I think from that standpoint there will be a blow in their prestige, at least temporarily.
We are talking to David Yaloff. He's a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut, where he also researches constitutional law. We're talking to him about the political implications of last night's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that effectively hands the presidency to Texas Governor George W. Bush. I want to remind you that we are learning from the Associated Press that Vice President Al Gore will talk to the nation tonight. He's expected to drop out of the presidential race. So far, Governor Bush has declined to comment this morning on the ruling, but has told reporters that he hopes to speak to the nation soon. We'd like to speak to you. It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Now, last night there was some consternation among Democrats when the head of the party said almost immediately upon hearing the decision that it was time for Al Gore to drop out. And then this morning he was sort of backtracking from that a bit. Talk about the Democratic response to this ruling.
Well, I think the Democratic response was a little bit in the dark, because all of us were in the dark. The decision was handed down a little bit after 10 o'clock. There were only about, you know, 50 to 100 people who actually were able to read the opinion within a half an hour. Everybody else was receiving faxes and summaries, and I thought under the pressure some of the network correspondents did quite well when you consider everything. Some didn't do so well. But I think the initial point made to Ed Rendell and others was it's a 5-4 loss. When you put that in light of Joe Lieberman's comments in the recent days, which is if we lose in the Supreme Court, we'll probably have to hang it up, and others, I think he probably put himself a little too far out on a limb, in the sense that he no doubt made that statement before he or people with him were able to read it, and no doubt made the statement before he had consulted with the Gore team. You should also know Bob Torricelli made a similar statement, and unlike Ed Rendell, is standing behind it.
No, that was the New Jersey. That's the senator from New Jersey.
That's correct. He has been a very outspoken person on a lot of issues, and he hasn't backed off at all. I think Ed Rendell's comment later last night, when I saw it, was he had said, if it is, you know, as absolute as it seems, then Gore should resign. And, you know, it's probably not the most insincere statement in the world, because I think his initial thought was that it was absolute. I think that lawyers for Gore said, can we please read it first? I think the fact that he's planning to address the nation tonight, and that there are leaks that he's planning to drop out, says that probably Ed Rendell's instincts turned out to be correct. He just didn't play the game very well PR-wise last night.
How would you characterize the Republican response?
Well, I think the Republican response, at least from the Bush people, has been quite measured, and that is appropriate. I think they are desperately trying to start the healing process right away. I have heard, and I'm sure you have heard and read, that there was celebrating, quote-unquote, going on in Austin, but there is no sense that there was partying going on of the sort that they had wanted to engage in on election night and were prepared to. I think it's been quite measured, but I think the real test of the Republican response is going to be after Al Gore's comments. Will the more conservative, ideologically conservative congressmen who've been waiting for this for so long, will they come out and, you know, basically lambast Gore's efforts and belittle them and talk about, you know, very hard right-wing conservative issues, or will they allow and be deferential to President-elect Bush's attempts to start healing the country? That'll be the real test after Vice President Gore's talk.
So who should we be watching? For instance, House Majority Whip Tom DeLay?
Oh, I think all cameras should be on Tom DeLay. There are rumors that Dick Cheney has been basically been assigned the task of going to Congress and telling Tom DeLay what he's allowed to say and what he isn't allowed to say. Tom DeLay has never been the type of person to take those kinds of instructions. But on the other hand, for the last 6 years, the last 8 years, he hasn't dealt with a Republican president. He has been one of the ostensible leaders of the party, and that's the ultimate irony, that the new leader of the party is President-elect Bush, and from that standpoint, he's going to have to learn to play second fiddle. Yes, I think people should watch Tom DeLay. I think people should watch Dick Armey, and I think people should watch Trent Lott. Trent Lott has had the propensity in recent weeks to not always say the most delicate of things. He made some comments about the First Lady that were not taken very well. I think people should watch them, and I would expect that they would be very cautious and very measured, but you never know.
Now, we've been talking about politics, as we invited you to do, but briefly, because you do research constitutional law, can you give me a reaction to the ruling itself?
Well, I think the ruling was very surprising in the sense that seven of the nine justices had some issues of equal protection. They believed that there was a potential equal protection violation in having different standards for different counties. But what's so interesting about it is that five of those seven, while feeling that way, were willing to rule that way despite the fact that they obviously saw right away and wrote, there is no remedy. I mean, it's kind of the ultimate irony when you see a problem but say, well, we recognize the problem, there's no solution. I mean, one argument could have been, why even take the case if by finding that kind of violation, you're not going to be able to do anything about it? And I think that's kind of what happened here in a way. Five justices believe that the safe ground was to overturn the Florida Supreme Court, but they made it even safer for themselves by saying, but guess what, we have no power to then ask the Florida Supreme Court to fix it because we're out of time. And so I think it was very surprising in that sense. I guess I expected it to be, you know, a little bit more of a slam dunk on either side. And what ended up happening was kind of classic judicial finagling and compromising. It ended up sitting in the middle in a way that, at least on legal grounds, very few people can be satisfied with. Certainly on political grounds, the Bush people are very satisfied.
And, of course, we want to remind you that if you would like to see the entire Supreme Court ruling, you can go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and access the Minnesota Public Radio news homepage, where we have that Supreme Court ruling. Meanwhile, let's turn to Joel in Maple Grove. Joel, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good. Seems to me that right now there are three major things at stake, or major institutions. One is the public confidence in the electoral system. The two is the legitimacy of the presidency itself, and three is the Supreme Court and their dignity. And it seems like all three are coming under attacks and taking some hits. And I think that is why, or do you think that is why, after Bush won the first count and the second count and some of the recounts, that's what is meant by the good of the country, that Gore should have stood down before then for the sake of those three major institutions. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that probably, especially given that Al Gore appears to be stepping down this evening, you know, the classic Monday morning quarterbacking, the classic hindsight is 2020 is going to be, why did you take us through this for 35 days? Pretty much you knew early on that those, you know, that those votes were not working in your favor, at least on the initial count and recount, and why didn't you just stop and save the country? I think that that's something you are going to hear. But I think that does miss something larger, which is a lot of court battles ultimately went against Al Gore in this case. If just one of them had gone for him, if Judge Nikki Clark in Seminole County had seen fit to throw out all those absentee ballots in the alleged fraud case, if just one of those had gone a different way, if Judge Sauls, instead of ruling against Al Gore on every count, had seen some openings for Al Gore, a lot of it could have been different. And so I think that's part of what I'd say is it's very easy now to look at it and say, why couldn't he have just given up? But so many things worked against him. And if one of them hadn't, we might be looking at it very differently. The only other thing I'd like to say is I think it's very easy to see this as one human being making a decision for himself. Why can't he, you know, be true to himself, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There were a lot of people who put their hopes and dreams in Al Gore and Al Gore's campaign. There were a lot of people who knocked on doors for both campaigns. There are a lot of appointments at stake. There's an entire federal bureaucracy with a lot of appointments that are going to be coming from the winner. And I'm not sure it's just so simple to say, Al Gore, after a week, why didn't you just fold your tents? Because there were a lot of people who looked at him and said, it's not just your decision. You know, we were behind you, and we need you to fight at least till the fighting can't be fought anymore. And so I'm a little worried that that's an oversimplification.
All right. Let's go to Al in St. Paul. Al, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you, Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that hand counts and intent of the voter have been used in standards in most states for a long time. And given what we've got now and the way it has been decided in such a partisan manner by the Supreme Court, the way the Republicans have handled this all the way through, I don't want a bipartisan Congress. I want gridlock. I want to treat the Republicans now the way they would have treated us if Gore had won, the way they treated Clinton when Clinton won.
Well, I think if the caller wants gridlock government, the caller is going to be very, very happy because I think that's exactly what you're going to have. And
well, I'm going to interject here, but do you think we're going to have gridlock because of partisan fighting, or do you think we're going to have the gridlock for some other reason?
Well, I think the partisan fighting is going to be at the center of it. I do honestly believe that Tom Daschle is in a really, really good situation for a person who's a minority leader.
How so?
He has half the Senate, and that is, even though that may not technically give him control of committees because Dick Cheney is able to vote that control, I think it gives him a tremendous advantage in terms of public opinion and the way things can be described. He is able to talk about half the Senate disagreeing, half the Senate not being behind things. I think it's a tremendous advantage from that standpoint, if you can't be the majority, to be able to have behind you that notion that you are at least nominally sharing control of that body. And so I think from that standpoint, what he's able to do, and you know how he does this is going to be very interesting, is say, look, you've got all three branches of you've got both houses of Congress, you've got the presidency, this is what you've wanted for the last 50 years, go run your government. You don't need my help. Run your government. And if the Democrats stay together, I think George W. Bush is going to have tremendous, tremendous problems governing. He's going to need to reach out to John Breaux. He's going to need to reach out to other more moderate Democratic senators. And I think that's where this measured tone and the dialogue over the next week is going to be so important, because that might be what allows the Democratic senators to kind of work with George W. Bush without looking like they're being disloyal. So I think the partisan bickering is going to be at the center of it, but I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of gridlock in the next 2 years.
Now, but we haven't seen this bickering yet. I mean, it sounds like the way you've characterized both Democratic and Republican response to this ruling, things are still sort of in check.
Well, they have been in check in part because nobody knew what the final outcome would be. But we have already seen parts of this, or some kind of aspects of this. The negotiations between Tom Daschle and Trent Lott over what will be the makeup of the committees in the Senate, will there be co-chairmen, will there be rotating chairmen, has gotten very spirited, in some cases very partisan. And I think that now that the presidential election has been decided, I think a lot of that is going to spill over into other areas. It is important to remember there are some initiatives that George W. Bush talked about in the campaign that will get a little bit of bipartisan support, the marriage penalty, some form of prescription drugs legislation. There are some pieces of legislation that might be able to cross lines, but it's hard to see a lot of that right now.
Let's go to Mark in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I am utterly disgusted by what happened. I support the vice president completely. I believe that the Republicans have stolen the election, that we should be rioting in the streets because, as far as I can see it, the Republicans stopped having a hand recount, which is generally quite common and acceptable all over the country for years, and so they ran out the clock, supposedly, and then the Supreme Court delivered the coup de grace, because Sandy O'Connor and Justice Rehnquist want to retire, and because Justice Scalia wants to be Chief Justice, and the only way he thinks he can be one is if he's got a Republican president. So I am utterly disgusted by this entire thing, and I'm going to write my congressman and say to fight them all every step of the way. And in 4 years, I hope we sweep them from power.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Professor?
Well, I don't think the caller is alone right now. The only thing I'd caution the caller about and a lot of people about is there often can be a short memory in these kinds of situations. It's not going to be that short. This took up our attention for 35 days. But, you know, that impeachment crisis, I remember I came on a couple times with you.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem like something that happened a long time ago. And if George W. Bush, in his first 6 months, is able to do what apparently he was able to do effectively in Texas, where he worked very closely with a Democratic lieutenant governor and did reach across party lines. If he is able to do that, and there's a lot in the way of that, but if he is able to do that, I think that it's quite possible that some of this kind of fervor, some of this kind of resentment will not totally be eliminated, but at least subside or diminish to a degree as people wait and see. But I will say also that if that isn't what happens, if the Tom DeLays and the Dick Armies are able to assert their authority, and if George W. Bush is not able to keep them in check, not able to stop those kinds of ideological fireballing, I think you are going to be in a situation where people are counting the days to the 2002 midterm election, where the Democrats may take back both houses, and to the 2004 election.
You've got some people doing that right now.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, there will always be large groups on both sides that are not going to shift from that. But that is not who runs the country. I mean, I think there are enough people out there, and I've heard some of the callers on other shows this morning who said, I'm a big supporter of Vice President Gore, but even I recognize, you know, we're going to have to move on. We've got problems in this country that we have to deal with. And there are always going to be both of those groups. And George W. Bush has within him the power to be able to decide whether one of those groups will increase or one of those groups will decrease. And a lot is going to be how he works with this Congress.
We're talking to David Yeloff. He's a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut, where he also researches constitutional law. We're talking to him about the political implications of last night's dramatic U.S. Supreme Court ruling that many say has effectively handed the presidency to Texas Governor George W. Bush. I want to remind you again that Vice President Al Gore is supposed to be talking to the nation tonight. We'd like you to talk to us right now. 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid Morning. We're going to turn now to Greta Cunningham. She's been keeping up with the latest in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.
Yes, I have. Thanks, Catherine, and good morning. The Associated Press is reporting Vice President Al Gore has decided to drop out of the presidential race. The move would clear the way for George W. Bush to become the nation's 43rd president. Gore made the decision 12 hours after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 against his bid to recount thousands of ballots in Florida. Gore had sought the recount in hopes he could overturn Bush's 537-vote victory margin in the state. Florida's 25 electoral votes will settle the presidential election. Gore's campaign chairman says Gore will address the nation tonight. Aides say George W. Bush won't speak until after Al Gore addresses the nation. Bush waved to reporters and smiled as he arrived at the Texas Capitol today, but did not answer questions about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling. He said he hoped to have a statement later. The Florida Senate is still planning to convene this afternoon despite the news that Al Gore is dropping out of the presidential race. The Florida Senate has before it a resolution to name a slate of presidential electors for George W. Bush, but it's not clear what the Senate will do today. The USS Cole is finally back home. The ship was damaged by a terrorist bomb in Yemen that killed 17 sailors. The Navy warship returned today to the Mississippi shipyard, where it was built for repairs. The United States and North Korea have opened talks on recovering the remains of more American servicemen missing from the Korean War. The sites where the remains have been recovered are along the Chongchang River. As many as 400 American soldiers were lost in the battle there. In regional news, workers have returned to their jobs at the Marvin Windows Factory in Grafton, North Dakota this morning. A carbon monoxide buildup yesterday forced about 280 of them to evacuate. 15 workers were treated at a nearby hospital for breathing problems. None was reported seriously injured. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for snow likely in the south, with a chance of light snow in central and northeastern Minnesota. It'll be mostly cloudy statewide today, with highs ranging from 5 below zero in the north to near 10 above in the south. At this hour, Duluth reports clear skies, a temperature of 4 below zero. It's cloudy in Rochester and 1 above. And in the Twin Cities, some clouds, a temperature of 2 above zero. That's a look at the latest news.
Thanks to all of you who made our recent membership drive a success. Your financial support provides the largest source of income for Minnesota Public Radio. Today's programming is sponsored in part by Bob Eckerin to celebrate the anniversary of the first broadcast of KNTN in Thief River Falls.
Hello, I'm Bill Kling, president of Minnesota Public Radio. Your response during our recent membership drive was very strong, and the result is that we're on track thus far to have a balanced budget for the year. Some of you who called made it clear that you could do more and that you'd like to know more about long-term support of Minnesota Public Radio. This is a good time of year to consider gifts of appreciated stock. Taking a deduction for a stock gift to MPR can be a very effective strategy. You can join the builders of MPR who have made the major gifts that have helped us grow to the level of service that we now provide and make sure that that service continues to grow and improve in the future. If you're interested in restricting a major gift for a special project, we'd be happy to visit about that. And if you'd like more information about making a stock gift, particularly before the end of the tax year, please call Katie at 651-290-1216 or visit our website at minnesotapublicradio.org. Again, thanks for partnering with us to make great radio.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio, where we are continuing our conversation on last night's dramatic Supreme Court ruling that has effectively handed the presidency to Texas Governor George W. Bush. Now, if you're interested in looking at that ruling for yourself, there's an easy way to get access to it. Go to the Minnesota Public Radio News homepage. How do you find that? Go to minnesotapublicradio.org, and you will find access to the homepage and thus the entire Supreme Court ruling. We're continuing our conversation this morning with David Yeloff. He's a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. He also researches constitutional law. If you'd like to join this conversation, it's 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000. Professor, before we go back to calls, much has been written in the last month about what a divided nation we are. Talk for a minute about the future of civil rights in this country. You have the NAACP. You have Jesse Jackson, in fact, I believe, referred to the Supreme Court ruling as the worst Supreme Court case since the Dred Scott decision. Talk about the political implications and the future of civil rights in the wake of this decision.
Well, you know, it's an interesting and thought-provoking question. I think that a lot is going to depend, again, on what kinds of justices come on the court in the next several years, and there will be vacancies. There is going to be, and I think that's what you're referencing in part with the NAACP and Jesse Jackson, there's going to have to be some serious efforts in the 107th Congress to propose some means of voting reform and some means of election reform. I don't think we ever reached a constitutional crisis here, but I think we did at several points reach an election crisis, a real sense that the election system that we have doesn't count everybody equally. It doesn't always work to our satisfaction. I understand that there have already been some initiatives proposed by John McCain and others that maybe there needs to be some money from the federal government freed up to states so that they can update and improve their election and their voting systems. And so those are the kind of things that I think the NAACP and Jesse Jackson and others are going to want movement on right away. I mean, this is fresh in our minds that even the Republicans and even the Bush campaign has recognized that there are some serious problems with this system. So, you know, that's kind of the immediacy. The long-term future of civil and constitutional rights is going to depend a lot on the composition of this court, what kinds of justices that George Bush decides to nominate, what kind of justices the deeply divided Senate is going to allow him to appoint. And so there are still a lot of questions that remain.
Let's go to Tracine in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. And I'm really glad to be on. I've been following this this election process for many weeks, and I've tried to call from time to time and haven't been able to get through. So thank you for allowing me this time. And saying that to say that I'm full of a lot of emotions, so please just bear with me. The first point I want to make is that people all the last several weeks kept referencing that Al Gore should be statesmanlike and concede this election right now. Why take this country through this process? But I say that he showed that he was a statesman by taking the high road. It would have been easier for him just to bow out, but it took a lot of character to stay in there and fight for principles. And I tell you, I don't think there are very few men in this that could do what he's going to have to do tonight, to stand before the public and to rally the country around the new president, and knowing that this election was totally stolen from him. Two, Bush all along during the campaign kept trying to portray Gore as a man that favored working at the federal level, but he was going to be the man that was going to trust the state. He wanted to take, you know, bring more of the power back to the state. But in this case, where the state clearly should have had the last word on what happened, he showed no lack of trust in what the state wanted to do. And it was the federal government. It was the federal government. And somebody, and I hope that this is brought home to him over and over again in the next couple of months, that it was the federal government that saved him.
All right. Thank you, Tracine.
Well, you know, I always criticize my students for losing the forest for the trees. I think one of the dangers in a situation like this is the opposite, that we may lose the trees for the forest, that sometimes the big picture, which is that Gore fought and fought and fought and lost, will kind of obscure some small moments and some important moments in the last 35 days, which tell us a lot about both individuals. And I think some of the points that the caller makes are quite right. There might be an impression by some people that Al Gore doesn't know how to concede. People forget he did concede, actually, briefly on election night. He actually retracted that concession. So there was at least some sense that he was not willing to, he was not going to be prepared to wait forever that evening. He is conceding tonight, despite the fact that there is still technically a way that he could win. He has said from the beginning, Al Gore has said, that he is not going to push for any electors to defect. And in essence, all he needs are two electors to defect to the Democratic camp, and he'll win the presidency in the Electoral College on the 18th. He has not pushed for that, and he has openly spoke against any efforts in that regard. So from that standpoint, I think it is easy to forget that Al Gore hasn't taken the most extreme positions he possibly could throughout this. And then I think there's another point, which maybe the caller didn't bring up, that a lot of people think that over the last 35 days, Al Gore may have cost himself any hope of the 2004 nomination, if that's what he wants. I don't know the answer to that question, Catherine, but you could make an argument that there was a tremendous amount of bravery on Al Gore's point to go forward, even though he knew that the polls were beginning to go against him.
You said that there were a lot of small moments that revealed much about the character of both men, and that those moments will probably be lost. Can you give us one or two?
Well, I was thinking to a couple of the moments on election night, first Al Gore's concession, and then when Al Gore called back and said, I'm retracting my concession, and what was, you know, much to George Bush's amazement, to which Al Gore apparently said, are you getting snippy with me? Don't get snippy. So there was a little kind of give and take there. I think there were some very interesting moments in the first week or two when George Bush, you know, took the political tactic, and it seemed to make sense at first. I'm going to start naming people. I'm going to bring Colin Powell to the ranch. You know, I'm going to start doing that because I need to create the inevitability image, and it was a complete disaster. Poll-wise, people thought he was being presumptuous. People thought he was being arrogant. He pulled back quite a bit, and that's something I think people can forget. He pulled back. We have not had those kinds of continuous announcements, which a lot of people expected. I think there was a real sense on the part of the Bush camp that this is a mistake. We need to pull back. If we have to hurry our transition, we do. If he's able to show those kinds of political flexibility when he's president, that will work to his favor. There's no question about it.
Let's go to Tom in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you. What often gets ignored in this is that Gore did win the election. He won the general election, and then even in the electoral college, anybody who is halfway intellectually honest knows that Gore won Florida and won the electoral college. It has been by procedures and blocking efforts of Bush to prevent him from winning. And when you take a look at the Supreme Court, it is extremely disappointing, not only on a partisan nature of the vote, but in what they said, in that what they wanted is equality of how the votes are counted. But they totally ignore the issues of the inequality of the electoral system, where we in Minnesota get essentially one vote per congressional district, but if you live across the border in South Dakota, you get three votes per congressional district, three times the vote that we have here in Minnesota. And also the difference between different economic areas as to the kind of voting equipment and the kind of designs of ballots, they totally ignore the inequality of that and only rule on the issue that will benefit Bush to allow him to win an election, which he lost. And I think that it's really mistaken upon people to suggest that what's best is for people to ignore this and be quiet and sit down and what happened. I would argue that when this nation is strongest, are things like the Boston Tea Party, the Revolution, the Civil Rights Movement, the anti-war movement, when people spoke up loudly because they felt there were injustices. And this is about as clear an injustice as you can have, the theft of a presidential election.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Professor?
Well, I think some of the points made, some of the criticisms about the Electoral College system, which the caller correctly points out, does give at least theoretically more power to individuals living in less populated states, is something that will come up in the next session of Congress. There very well may be some movement on the part of Democrats to offer some kind of amendment to the Constitution to change the Electoral College. I think it's unlikely to gather three-quarters of the state legislatures for ratification purposes, but I think that will come up and be debated, and I think that'll be a healthy debate. The one thing I would take a little bit of exception to the caller's point was about the whole issue of intellectual honesty. I think it's tough to accuse either side of being intellectually honest or dishonest, simply because many of the voting experts have told us that, quite simply, the machinery of this country is not set up to effectively deal with an election that is this close. There is a degree of error in these machines, and basically, frankly, I think the most intellectually honest position you could take here is we had as close as you can have to an outright tie. And the system just is not made to deal with outright ties. I think a lot of people suspect that there were individuals who went to the voting booths to vote for Al Gore and either voted for Pat Buchanan too or didn't dimple their chat enough, but there were rules set up, and I know that's something that the Bush campaign people have spoken of. There were rules set up. It's the interpretation of those rules that have been debated for the last 35 days. So I guess I would be a little wary of throwing accusations of intellectual dishonesty at either side in this case.
Let's go to Dwight in Eden Prairie. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning, and I appreciate the comments that were just made. I think if we don't follow our Constitution and the laws in place, whether we're, you know, happy with the results or not, we end up with anarchy. And it's, you know, as unpleasant as this whole day might be for some folks, I'm happy with the results of last night's decision just simply because it kept the company in, or the country in check. I think everybody should be happy with the fact that the system did work and we avoided a crisis. That's all I have to say. I was a little upset with people calling up and saying that an election was stolen. I don't agree with that. So that's my comment.
Okay.
Well, I think that the caller is right in the sense that we didn't have a constitutional crisis. We did, I think, at moments have an electoral crisis. I know I said that before. We've always had faith that the election system will produce winners and hopefully the right winners, and now we don't have quite that same amount of faith. But I think you made reference earlier, Catherine, to the Dred Scott decision. That was obviously a self-inflicted wound on the part of the court in 1857, and a lot of people suspect it may have facilitated or quickened the Civil War that was initiated 4 years later. That was, I think, a constitutional crisis in the sense that there were a lot of people who believed that political officials were going to ignore the Supreme Court if they didn't rule the way they wanted them to. Abraham Lincoln openly, in his eloquent way, called for individuals to change the Dred Scott decision, if not outright defy it. And I think that never happened here. Both sides seem to be prepared to accept the Supreme Court's ruling, whatever it is. And so I think we were able to avert that constitutional crisis, as the caller suggests.
A self-inflicted wound, you'd be quoting from Justice Breyer's dissent. There were a number of very strident dissents. In fact, Ruth Bader Ginsburg didn't sign hers. She didn't respectfully dissent. She just merely dissented. We've been talking about the ruling. Talk for a minute about the dissents.
Well, I think it was interesting, first of all, how they divided it up. Ruth Bader Ginsburg and John Paul Stevens were not willing to say that there was any kind of equal protection violation. The other two individuals in the dissent, Justice Souter and Justice Breyer, recognized that there might be equal protection issues, but had faith that it was possible for the Florida Supreme Court in Florida to deal with those issues and address them in the 6 days that remained before the Electoral College met. I think the dissents, are strident, but I have seen in the opinions I've read much worse, much more harsh rhetoric. I think that your point about Justice Ginsburg's dissent is well taken. It was not respectfully delivered. I think there's a tremendous frustration on the part of these four dissenters. But let me also say, I think the biggest frustration on their part is not so much that the decision didn't go the way they wanted to. I think you can read between the lines and sometimes in the lines, they did not think that the court should have taken this case in the first place. That is the debate that I think centered around Justice Scalia's concurrence and Justice Stevens' dissent when they first decided to take this case a few days ago. And I think that's where the real bad feelings on the court may still sit. There really was a sense that this is not the kind of situation the court routinely enters, and that by entering it, they put themselves in a position where their legitimacy could be questioned.
Let's go to Steve in Edina. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Okay.
Good. I'd like to give the other side of this. A lot of my Republican friends, the more moderate wing of our party, have been talking the same way as many of you have been talking this morning about the Republicans having to reach a hand of friendship over to the Democratic side, and that George Bush needs to reach across the aisle to the Democrats in a show of friendship. That has to go both ways. And what I have said is that the Republicans, I'm a conservative, and the Republicans better be prepared to fight a war. Because the Democrats are. The Democrats are prepared for battle. And I use as an example NPR this morning. I tell my more moderate friends to listen to NPR and see what the other side is saying. And what the other side is saying is, 2 years from now, we're going to wipe them out in Congress. 4 years from now, we're going to take over the entire Congress and White House. And the Republicans better understand that if the Democrats want to fight, then they've got to fight too. And right now, we have the upper hand. if Bush does indeed prevail. And they better make sure that they know how to be the majority, because if they don't, they will lose it. And if all you're going to be is conciliatory to the other side, and the other side is waiting to stab you in the back, you better be awfully careful.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Well, it's an interesting point raised. I think that the war that the caller is talking about is really going to be a war of public opinion. I agree with the caller. I don't think the Democrats can look like they are refusing to do anything, like they are engaged in a stonewall. The country be damned. We're not going to help you one iota. I don't think that will work in public opinion. And I think if the Democrats are planning to try to take back the House and Senate in 2002, I'm not sure that is necessarily going to work if that's the way it's portrayed. But on the flip side, I think the caller may have a short memory. Eight years ago when Bill Clinton took office, I think the Republicans did make his life very difficult. I think the Democrats did try to engage in a war, but I don't think it was successful. And as a result, the Republicans had a tremendous election year in 1994, winning back both houses of Congress for the first time in many years, 40 years in the case of the House. So this war is going to be a war of public opinion, and if you don't act like a majority. I think the caller is right. The Republicans have the upper hand, but I think they have to act like they have the upper hand in a responsible way, or I think the public could turn on them quickly. The same thing could happen to the Democrats if the Republicans do reach out and the Democrats refuse to even acknowledge their existence. I'm not sure that's going to work as well. So I think the war that the caller is talking about is the war of public opinion, and in that sense, we'll be the ones who decide who does it well or not.
All right. We're talking to David Yeloff. He's a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. We're talking about last night's late night dramatic ruling from the United States Supreme Court that many say has effectively handed the presidency to Texas Governor George W. Bush. Now, if you'd like to see that ruling, we urge you to go to the NPR News homepage. You can access that at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. I also want to remind you that according to the Associated Press, Vice President Al Gore will address the nation tonight. According to CNN, he'll be speaking about 8 p.m. and will be preceded by Joseph Lieberman, his running mate, Senator Joseph Lieberman. If you'd like to join our conversation today, it's 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Let's go to Chris in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi,
Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
I was a Nader supporter initially, and then I switched over to Gore when I saw that things were getting tough for Gore. And I think the previous caller is just a perfect example of the adversarial nature that this is all about to Republicans. All the Democrats I know are interested in what's good and right for the majority of the public, and all the Republicans that I've talked to are simply interested in what's best for themselves. And I mean, they always talk about the damn taxes, and I think that caller on the previous call just exemplified the nature that
Chris, he didn't mention taxes once, as I recall.
Correct, he didn't. But that's what I'm saying is that all the Republicans that I talk to are all concerned about what's in their own self-interest, and
Okay, Chris. Thanks. Any reaction, Professor?
I guess I'm just surprised that somebody who has such a positive view of Democrats in general would ever be a Nader supporter. I just found that surprising.
Okay. We're going to go to Linda in St. Paul. Linda, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have two comments. One quickly about Gore's intention of dropping from the election. Does that mean withdraw or concede, or is there a difference? And if it is just withdrawing, what are the implications of that? And then just listening to the BBC, the opinions from overseas are that there was a filibuster in the Republican camp and essentially that they stole the election. So I'd just like to find out what you think about that. Thank you.
All right.
I don't know anything about the second point that was just raised. I'm not really sure that the difference between withdraw and concede is as big a deal. It certainly holds no legal advantage or distinction, and I think probably the speechwriters are wrestling with it. I think it's important to the Gore people that they not concede somehow that Bush got more votes. I don't think they want to concede that at all, because I think that would get their supporters very upset, because they do remain convinced that that didn't happen. So I think if you're going to concede, it's one thing to concede that the electoral system appears to have weighed in George W. Bush's favor under the rules set out. It's another thing to concede that the public actually chose the other person. I'm guessing that Al Gore is going to stop short of that.
Well, in fact, but getting back to this is how we started the conversation, talking about what language Gore should use tonight. But doesn't the nation as a whole need to hear someone say uncle?
Well, you know, yes, they do, but what type of uncle? And how much do you like your uncle? We're going to push that metaphor too far, but I will say this. I think the important aspect, the important part of the speech is that he has to throw his full and unadulterated support behind President-elect Bush, and he has to urge his supporters to do the same. And as well, he cannot use so much other kind of bitter, quote-unquote, sore loser language that he ends up, in a way, undercutting that support. That was an accusation that was leveled against John McCain when George W. Bush beat him, mm-hmm. that while he supported him, he looked so reluctant, so unhappy about it that nobody really believed it. Al Gore cannot look like John McCain did. He just can't. And I think he has to balance that when he writes that speech tonight.
Okay, Bob in St. Peter, you have to be really quick.
Okay, listen, I'm just thinking about the debates when George W. Bush said that when it was time for him to appoint somebody to the Supreme Court, that he'd like to find somebody like Scalia or Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And now that the Supreme Court is, in fact, Scalia and Thomas have essentially given him the presidency, and a lot of Democrats feel like they were robbed, I'm wondering what's going to happen when there is a vacancy.
All right. Thank you, Bob.
Well, that's a subject of special interest to me, and I don't know the answer to that. As a Texas governor, George Bush nominated some moderates. He did not use the bench as a chance to go far right or to create a real ideological bench, but he is going to be under tremendous pressure from the constituents who helped get him elected and from the Tom DeLays and from the Christian Coalition and Ralph Reed to come through with a formidable conservative nominee when he gets the chance.
But there's been some analysis that has said that, in fact, he'll be pressured because of the closeness of this election to appoint more moderates.
Well, he will be pressured, but not within his own group. He'll probably be pressured by those within the White House who have other priorities. I mean, that's the important point, Catherine. If your priority is tax cut, if your priority is prescription drugs, health care, et cetera, you are not going to be able to push a conservative ideologue onto the court because you could lose a lot of capital for all those other things. And John Kennedy made a note not to put an extreme liberal on the court in the early 60s because his priority was with economic packages or other issues.
All right.
It's all where you stand.
All right, David Yaloff, we stand at the end of our hour. I want to thank you for joining us today.
I enjoyed it very much.
All right. David Yaloff is a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut, where he also researches constitutional law. Again, we want to remind you that according to the Associated Press, Vice President Al Gore will talk to the nation tonight, and it is widely expected that he will drop out of the presidential race. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio.
Today's programming is supported by 3M, which generously matches more than 900 employee contributions to NPR.
Minnesota Public Radio.